I'm delighted now to welcome to the Radio Cafe Beth and George Gage. They are co-directors and producers of the documentary film Bitter 70, which will be screening on Tuesday, September 24th at The Screen. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Glad to be here.
Great to be here. Thank you.
So this is a film about Tim DeChristopher, who will be speaking on Wednesday, the 25th of September, here in Santa Fe at the Lensic. And unfortunately, that is sold out. So if people don't already have their tickets, there's not an opportunity to go. And that's one of the reasons that this film is being screened the day before. Tell us a little bit about Tim DeChristopher, what he did. The movie is called Bitter 70, and he bid on some land. Tell us the story.
Yes, the reason it's called Bitter 70 is that is the number that Tim was handed when he went in to protest the Bureau of Land Management oil and gas lease auction in 2000, very, very end of 2008 in Salt Lake City. And they were auctioning off some land, hundreds of thousands of acres around a lot of national parks, Canyonlands, Arches, Dinosaur National Monument, in the Utah and Colorado Four Corners area. And a lot of environmentalists had been protesting this, but it was the very end of the Bush administration, and, you know, it was sort of the Bush administration's last chance to allow drilling on these lands. And so it was going ahead, and Tim was one of the protesters. He'd left his college exam to go down and protest, and realized that they weren't getting much notice outside, so he decided to go inside, and when he walked inside the building, someone asked him if he was here for the auction, and he said yes, he was, and they said, are you here to be a bidder? And, you know, he thought for a second, he said, well, yes, I am. And they handed him a bidder's card, and once he got into the auction, he realized that a way for him to maybe really cause some problems for the auction was to bid on the land. And he thought about it long and hard because he knew that it obviously wasn't the correct thing to do, right? But he felt that if he didn't do it, he'd be more upset with himself. So he ended up bidding on the land, and after an hour or so, he had won, I think it's 22,000 acres of land. He'd bid $1.8 million. And then, you know, the officials got sort of wise that, why is this young guy buying all this land? And they stopped the auction, took him out. And that was the beginning of the idea of our film, where we thought, wow, this is a really ingenious act, because it did actually end up saving that land.
So at first it seemed to us like this was going to be a short film, because this one ingenious act of peaceful civil disobedience had some fantastic results in terms of saving all this great land outside of Arches and Canyonlands. But then in April, on April 1st, when Tim was indicted by the Obama administration and faced up to 10 years in prison and $750,000 in fines, suddenly we realized this is not a short story. This story is going to go on and on.
And so you'd already started making the documentary by then.
Yes.
Right.
Yeah. We started, as soon as I read about what Tim had done, I brought the newspaper article, local Telluride, Colorado newspaper home, showed it to George, and we both agreed that this was, you know, was an ingenious and interesting situation, and that we'd like to meet this young man. And then, very coincidentally, serendipitously, we met him within a week at another film festival and talked to him about our idea, and he was encouraging, and we met, and we've had a 4+ year relationship now.
And because we jumped on this story right away, everything in the film, basically, we shot. The only thing we weren't around for was the original auction, and luckily, as a matter of course, some government officials and some television station and people with cell phones, et cetera, shot enough inside the auction, including Sally Schatz, a still photographer, that we were able to cobble together that scene, even though we weren't working on the film yet. But from that point on, everything in Bitter 70 has been shot by us.
Now, why was it illegal what Tim DeChristopher did? Let's say I had a couple of million dollars sitting around and I went in there and started bidding and came up with the cash. Would that still be illegal?
Well, apparently the Bureau of Land Management wouldn't accept the money, even after Tim, through his website and attorney, had raised enough money to make the down payment on the land,
right,
because he didn't intend to drill on it. The auction was for drilling. I mean, if you had a couple of million dollars and did what Tim did, and said, you know, I really do want to buy this land, they wouldn't probably put you in jail. They probably wouldn't charge you, but they also wouldn't give you the land, because basically it was an auction for oil and gas exploration. But in fact, Tim didn't have the $1.8 million, although his supporters and friends from his local Unitarian church, I mean, they just started scrambling. And within a week, he'd raised over $80,000, and they did send it to the Bureau of Land Management, and it was returned to Tim.
And also, I wanted to mention that there have been at least 20 people in recent history that have bid and won land with no intention to drill, and they have not been prosecuted. In other words, they bought it on speculation. They weren't themselves intending to do the drilling, or they weren't direct, maybe, representatives of oil and gas.
We're talking about the film Bitter 70, and I think there's many things about this film that are really important, and one of them is that, I mean, Tim DeChristopher is a young man. He was in his 20s when he did this, and he was basically doing a direct action because he saw, as I think many of us see, that all the organizing and voting in the world doesn't seem to make a difference when you are looking at the fight against global climate change.
Mm-hmm. That's
correct.
That's absolutely true. And I think there was a turning point for Tim. He's a really terrific young man, and he had taken off time from college a few years earlier to work with troubled youth in the desert and doing survival work and things like that. And then he'd gone back to school at the University of Utah. And he was very troubled by global warming and what was happening. And it wasn't until he listened to a speech given by Dr. Terry Root, who is one of the Nobel Peace Prize-winning scientists, the year that Al Gore won. When he listened to that speech and found out that no matter what we do, it was pretty much too late to reverse the effects of climate change, that he just was so upset and so depressed and felt, you know, we have to do something. I have to do something. And for the next year, he sort of brooded about it and thought about it and tried to make himself educated on how best he could address this. And then when this opportunity kind of presented itself to him, he just took it. You know, it wasn't that he had gone in there and decided, hey, this is what I'm going to do. I'm going to, you know, foil this auction. It just seemed like, you know, sort of an opening, like, you know, like sitting down on a bus when blacks are supposed to go to the back of the bus, that sort of thing. There was the opportunity, and he just grabbed it. And there have been quite a few people who said to George and to me, well, he broke the law, and he shouldn't have done that. But, you know, here's a young man who was very willing to accept the consequences of what he did to make a difference. And so for that, we really applaud his actions.
Absolutely.
And the whole question of, you know, you spend your life working for the candidates that you believe in, and so many people believed in Obama, and then it's the Obama administration that's prosecuting him.
Yeah.
It was a shock to us. It really was. When we got the phone call that he was being indicted, and it was just a shock to us. And there have been many attempts to reach out to President Obama about this injustice, but nothing really has materialized.
One of the ironies of this also is that the new Secretary of the Interior under Obama basically withdrew those lands from potential oil and gas drilling. Why did
That's
he
correct.
Do that?
Well, you know, we asked Tim's lawyer, Patrick Shea, who was the head of the Bureau of Land Management in the Clinton administration, and he became Tim's pro bono attorney, one of Tim's attorneys. And basically, I think the idea is that the Obama administration and Secretary Salazar as the Secretary of Interior did believe that these lands shouldn't have been drilled on, but they didn't feel strongly, apparently, about the fact that the young man who called attention to it had broken the law, and therefore they weren't about to pardon him or to not indict him. And what Mr. Shea said is they just didn't see any upside to it. They're already, you know, they are politicians, and they were already not creating any friends, obviously, in Utah by taking that land out of the bidding process for energy. And yet, and I guess he just felt that they'd further alienate those interests if they let Tim go free.
Another fact is that before Tim knew and before his lawyers knew, the oil and gas industry knew that he was going to be indicted.
Very interesting. I mean, this is a case of what's called selective prosecution. As you said, a lot of people do the same kind of thing, and only this person was prosecuted and indicted and convicted. Why did they choose him? Why was this particular action so important to try to punish?
Well, the reason was that Tim, number one, he said that he was doing it for basically environmental or political reasons, that he wasn't trying to buy the land so he could make money off it. He was trying to buy the land to save these beautiful lands from, you know, oil and gas pollution and drilling. And therefore, he was punished for that. I mean, in other words, if you bought this land and then at the last minute decided, you know what, I really don't want to spend all this money on this land, or I can't find someone else to buy it from me, so I just won't pay for it, there have been 26 people who did that and got away with it. Tim, because he was honest and honorable and said, this is the reason I did it, and it was, you know, as a direct action of peaceful civil disobedience, he was punished for that. And the judge said more than once in court that he did not agree or understand Tim's actions or motives.
One of the things that helped us make a full-length documentary film, a feature-length documentary film, are these constant postponements of the trial. And Tim, rather than sit around and brood or fear what's going to happen or go to the local pub or whatever, he continued his activism. In fact, he's from West Virginia, and we went out to West Virginia because he had a real desire to see what was happening with mountaintop removal out there. He also bonded with Larry Gibson, who's the biggest activist against mountaintop removal in that area. He started a citizen's candidate where he went out on Craigslist and found a candidate to run against the conservative Blue Dog Democrat, Matheson, for Congress. So Tim was constantly doing things as these trials were postponed, and the postponements lasted for over 2.5 years, and that, as filmmakers, gave us an opportunity to follow all the activism that Tim was doing, including speaking at Power Shift, et cetera, et cetera.
We're talking to Beth and George Gage about their documentary, Bitter 70. One thing that the film gives you the chance to think about is why there's so much less civil disobedience now than there was, for example, during Vietnam. What do you think is going on?
Well, I think one of the things, and Beth can elaborate on it, during Vietnam, I'm from that era, I was set to be drafted and go to Vietnam, and then luckily I failed my physical. But, you know, our tails were on the line. In other words, I mean, our life was on the line. I mean, we had seen enough news and enough news footage to know the mess that we'd be going into as young soldiers. And one of the things that's going on right now is the news media is so limited and so controlled by corporate business that we really don't know so much of what's going on in the world. I mean, do we turn on the television and ever see anything about Afghanistan, anything about what's going on in Iraq? Very little about really what's going on in Syria right now. That's one reason.
I think that in the, you know, late 60s and 70s, when there was so much civil disobedience and, you know, young people marching in the streets and taking different sorts of actions, the opposition to that wasn't as solidified as it is now. I think that the opposition has learned over the past 40 years or whatever it's been that to not give people like Tim DeChristopher an easy voice, not show on the evening news all of the sit-ins or the Occupy, when there was Occupy Wall Street. I mean, it took a long time for the media to even notice that and to start to pay any attention to that. And I think that also, you know, it's become a harder time. I mean, it was a lot easier in the 60s and the 70s to pay for college. Now people are much more concerned about protecting what they have, and they don't want to take chances on being fined or sent to prison and things like that. It's I think it's a steeper hill right now for people to protest. And the fact that global warming, even though we see the effects of it every day around us in so many different aspects, it's not quite as immediate as being sent off to Vietnam or when, you know, also when young women were protesting abortion rights. I mean, there are certain things that are a little more immediate feeling than this sort of amorphous global problem. And I think that, you know, the opposition is just very well entrenched as far as not either encouraging that action or covering it.
Also, I think that we felt going to college during those years that we would graduate from college and maybe not graduate from college or maybe not go to college, but there'd be a pretty good job waiting for us. Now it seems like the young people are so concerned, and rightfully so, that unless they've got their nose to the grindstone continually, they're not going to get those few good jobs that are existing out there. So I think that's a tendency to take them away from getting involved. And I think also there may be something in the concept of the me generation, where everyone right now, or not everyone, but so many young people are so concerned with money, material things, social network, but they're not really concerned with some of the big issues. And you find that as you struggle with a film that has a theatrical release, is that we stand there and do our Q&A and we look out at the 150 or 200 people that came, and we see gray hair. We don't see the youth, and it frustrates us. And I've heard many reasons why the youth doesn't come out. One of the reasons is, well, they really don't go to movies. They watch it all on their telephone, or they watch it all on, you know, Facebook or whatever, Hulu, whatever. But I just don't think it's kind of disappointing, because when you actually take part in something and actually go to a theater, listen to the Q&A, get to meet people with the same ideas that you have, to me that's how a movement is formed, as opposed to sitting on your couch watching the same film on Hulu.
One of the goals that Tim DeChristopher had in not taking a plea bargain and going through a full jury trial in really taking this accusation to the full extent of the law, knowing that he could have served a few days in jail instead of a few years, whatever, was the hope to get the word out and to empower other people to take action. How successful do you think that has been?
Well, you know, it was very difficult in his trial, and that's one of the things I think that was a huge, huge disappointment to Tim, was he hoped that by getting his story out, first of all, to the jury, he was quite optimistic, or hopeful, let's not say optimist, but he was hopeful that if they understood the story, that they would not find him guilty. Well, the Judge Dee Benson, was so, you know, he so totally controlled the information that got out to the jury that no one was able to really tell the story of what happened. No one knew where the land was. No one knew why Tim took the action that he did. There was just so much. No one knew that there were 26 other people who had taken similar actions and never been indicted. So it was just almost impossible for the jury to understand why a young man would do something like this. So first of all, they never got that information. And then one of the things that any of your listeners that are going to be at the talk with Tim and Terry might find out, because it's really important to Tim, is that Peaceful Uprising, of which Tim was a co-creator and supporter, got a lot of information out in Salt Lake City on something called jury nullification. And it was information on, you know, what sort of information a jury can get and what sort of findings they can make. In other words, they can find that this person really should not have been charged. And when the judge and the prosecution found out about that, they asked all of the potential jurors if they'd been, if anyone had talked to them about this jury nullification. And many of the jurors raised their hand. So they were all brought into the judge's chamber, and Judge Benson, and I hope I'm, you know, explaining this correctly, because, it, you know, Tim was there and I was.
Tim recalls it exactly how it happened.
Yeah, and they were all asked if they could, number one, disregard anything that they had been told or read, and number two, if they would absolutely abide only by the instructions that the judge gave them, and that they would disregard whatever their conscience told them or, you know, anything else, and just go by purely the directions and instructions of the judge. And Tim sat there as every single one of these potential jurors said, "Yes, Your Honor, I'll do that. I'll disregard my own personal thoughts and just go by the instructions." And he said when he heard that, he knew that not only would he get convicted, but that there was a really big problem out there when people can't even use their own conscience to make decisions, and those are the people that are deciding our fate. So, you know, that part of it for him kind of backfired. But what was really good about that is it solidified Tim's determination to try and make a difference in even a larger sense, in more of a kind of spiritual, philosophical sense, and that's what he's working on now.
It is a kind of a case of a judge hijacking a jury, because the judge already has made up his mind about the innocence or guilt of the person on trial.
Yeah, seems that way.
So Tim DeChristopher has served his sentence. He's going to be here in Santa Fe on Wednesday, and he is on his way this fall to Harvard Divinity School. Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct.
He's already there. He's already...
As I understand it, he was awarded what they call a presidential scholarship, which is awarded, I guess, by the president of the university, and it's a full scholarship.
Yeah.
Well,
he's very happy about it and very excited about it.
Yeah, I don't know how many other convicted felons who are on 3 years of probation are also doing 3 years at Harvard Divinity School.
The film is called Bitter 70. It is screening at the Screen on the campus of the Santa Fe University of Art and Design on Tuesday, the 24th of September. Beth and George Gage are co-directors and co-producers of this film. Thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
You're very welcome.
It's been our pleasure.
And George and I will be at the screening, and so we'll do a Q&A afterwards if anybody comes.
Excellent.
And we hope they will.
Has the film been widely screened?
Yes, it has. It had a New York opening and a Los Angeles opening. It's played in what they call one-offs, in other words, one night, just like it's playing in Santa Fe. I think about 40 cities around the United States, and it's played in many, many film festivals where it's garnered 20 awards, including Best American Film at Michael Moore's Traverse City Film Festival.
And are you taking it to college campuses as well?
Yes, we are.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely.
We have an educational distributor called Bullfrog, and they'll be doing a lot of screenings and at different universities around the country.
Yeah.
Well, again, thanks so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Our pleasure. Thank you very much.